this is where Texas politics gets interesting. Here again are two guys named Jason, some great guests, and cold Texas beer for another smart conversation on Y'allitics, the unofficial political podcast of Texas.
Welcome back to Y'allitics here, guys. Back in the Y'allitics lounge, and Wheeler has built a wall between us here.
I have.
Dude, what's going
about
on,
time.
Man? Before we started, you didn't have that here. Why are you doing that?
Chance of build the wall here on Y'allitics began long before that became
right.
a thing in actual politics.
Perhaps you could offer some advice on how
now
easy
we've got a
how
separation between us. Like the one that my wife has created with pillows between us. Because I have multiple fans, and she can't stand it, so she has this wall of pillows now. Yeah,
I don't know if Mrs. Wheeler would approve of that conversation.
I don't think she
on this
would.
Podcast. So I'll let you pass on that one. Hey, I bought the beer last night at 10 o'clock after I left my kids' soccer practice.
Oh, okay.
And of course, I went to the fruit section for you. And this is from Allstadt from Fredericksburg.
Wow, I've never heard of a Radler.
A peach.
Peach Radler.
Radler.
And it has a very German-looking can too. I'm impressed.
Yeah, Fredericksburg is that brewery is fantastic.
You bought the good
in a great
stuff.
City. I always buy you the good stuff, and you. Bring me the old
you shook
things.
It too, didn't
I,
was, you?
I should have. That wasn't planned. I have a Texas Pilsner. I'm a Pilsner fan, so this is Stubbs
oh, wow.
from Lakewood Brewing in Dallas.
This is very peachy.
Is it good?
Yeah, don't they? I think they grow peaches in Fredericksburg, do they not?
I don't know. I thought it was East Texas.
No, I think Fredericksburg is known for its peaches. Am I going to have to look this up?
Yeah.
I live in Coffman County.
It's near Terrell, right? This is our producer, Daryl Golden, behind the camera
Hold on,
here.
Real quick, I'm going to look this up.
Yeah, you need to put a microphone on you because Wheeler's now going to pause the entire podcast here.
No, I mean, I can still talk.
To find out where the peach capital of Texas is.
I am capable of talking and typing at the same time.
Where is the peach capital of Texas?
Things to do in Fredericksburg, Texas, peaches. Fredericksburg, Texas, well known for the fresh Texas peaches, peach orchards and peach stands that line the roadsides. Some of us go to Fredericksburg sometimes, Whiteley, for more than just the drinking tours. No, they are well known for their peaches, and it is very prominent in this. And I'll tell you what.
That makes sense, then.
I would have this beer alongside a warm, steaming bowl of peach cobbler. That would be amazing.
Wow.
Just peach overload.
Once again, you put up a left turn. I don't know which way to go on.
Another wall.
In this podcast.
If people want to visit a peach orchard in North Texas.
In North Texas.
There is Ham Orchards in Terrell, Texas.
Okay, Terrell, Texas, too, if you like peaches, but it pops up right away as one of the things to do in Fredericksburg.
Yeah, and your search parameters were where to pick peaches in Fredericksburg, probably, right? at Grandma's house.
But our focus is not,
sure.
not the Hill Country.
No, our focus is the Gulf Coast.
Yes, it is.
And our hearts go out to what happened there to the millions of people who live along the Gulf Coast. They're used to storms.
Yeah.
They're used to the devastation they bring. And unfortunately, folks in this state are used to
power
electric
outages.
Failures
yeah.
when it comes to severe weather here,
Well, sometimes when it's not even severe weather. But certainly when severe weather happens, and my mom is one of those refugees who has left Southeast
right.
Texas for the confines of my house in DFW because she has no power and she can't stand it. I mean, it's unbearable. Houston heat is unbearable on a good day when you've got fans and air conditioners and all that stuff, but especially when you don't have those things.
So what's coming to light now, what we're almost a week after the storm, what's coming to light is that CenterPoint, which is the main utility down there, electric utility, wasn't prepared.
Yeah, I think they call it a TDU. So it's a transmission and distribution utility. You have your power company that you pay your bill to, and there are a million of those. But the TDU is the one who actually handles the transmission of all of that electricity. So they handle it for all of that area.
They own the lines and the poles.
The lines and the poles. And the lines and the poles haven't done so well. For those of you who are watching us and not just listening to us, by the way, as we record this, this is the current outage map or re-energization map that CenterPoint has. And if you look there, the light greens are the partially energized, as they call them, and the browns there that you see are assessment in progress. Still a lot of browns out there. Assessment in progress basically means we're still looking at it. We haven't quite gotten to it yet, but you can see it's not a pretty situation for a lot of the area there. They have had some people energized, though. neat thing is before this map, apparently this took a while to get up and going. And
this was, yeah, this wasn't going during the storm, and everyone's asking, where's CenterPoint? Why can't we see what's going on? You know who they relied on?
Good old Whataburger.
Seriously, I thought this was a meme when I first saw it scrolling through social media.
Check this out right here. This is Whataburger. This was their outage map. because basically, if you looked up Whataburger locations, the ones in gray, which was most of the area there around Houston, those are the ones that didn't have power, so they were closed. The ones that are orange, the typical Whataburger orange, were the ones that were open. And so that's how people could tell sort of where power was and wasn't.
So shout out to Whataburger here for being able to stay online when CenterPoint could not. CenterPoint's outage map has been offline since mid-May when they had that last freak storm.
The derecho.
The derecho that crumpled their huge transmission towers. Mm-hmm. And now they have this going on down there. The stats, though, are unbelievable. Right now, after this hurricane, a Category 1.
Category 1.
The lowest you can get. On the hurricane scale, mm-hmm. 2.7 million people in CenterPoint's area without power. 80% of all their customers do not have power. So our colleague down there at KHOU is Jeremy Rogalski, senior investigative reporter. He started getting calls, and he started wondering himself, when he's driving around, like a lot of folks are in Houston, why am I seeing bucket trucks sitting in parking lots, these electric utility trucks that have need to be out there working. And the folks who are out there working, our hats off to them because these are long days and we know what's involved with that. He started seeing these and he started wondering, why are so many sitting over there?
Mm-hmm. And to CenterPoint's, defense a little bit here, these are mammoth things to take on, especially when you're dealing with such a wide area. But the question goes to, what was your preparation? Because, we understand, things being kind of wild, but you try to take out as much of that wildness in the preparation, the planning beforehand, not waiting until afterwards where people are sitting in parking lots while you're trying to figure out what's going on. But is that what was happening? Well, that's what Jeremy was kind of setting out to find out.
And Jeremy was, and what he discovered in some of his reporting, if you're listening to this from the Houston area, he discovered in his reporting that normally, a lot of utilities plan and call neighboring states and say, hey, we got a hurricane or we have a bad storm on the way. Can you come over here and stage and help us out because we're expecting some bad stuff? Well, come to find out, CenterPoint didn't do that. Mm-hmm. CenterPoint had, I think 2,500, 5,300 trucks.
Right.
They ended up calling in 12,000 after this Category 1 came ashore.
Right.
So Jeremy's been talking to a number of people from the C-suite to the director of communications there, and we want to play one of the interviews, just part of this here. This is with Alicia Schody. She is the spokeswoman for CenterPoint Energy, and Jeremy's asking her questions. What was the plan before Hurricane Beryl came ashore? Because this was not a surprise. Here's what she said.
Before the storm hit, we had a plan in place and had already requested crews to join us. After that storm hit and we saw the damage that resulted, we made additional calls. So we still have those additional crews that we've requested coming to join us in this area and traveling from various states.
So CenterPoint, correct me if I'm wrong, made two requests, one prior to the storm for outside help. How many thousands of personnel was requested in that first go around?
In the first go round, we had roughly 2,500 resources that were requested, and we arrived at that number due to what was projected and the information that we received by engaging various storm experts, looking at how the storm could potentially impact the area, and felt confident that that was the number of resources that we would need. Now, we know about the unpredictability that comes with storms, and that's something that happened with Hurricane Beryl. While we knew it was headed this way, the true impact was not known until after. So we quickly then made the assessment that we would need additional help. And so thankfully, we've got a lot of utilities that have answered that call, and we're very appreciative of them coming to assist us in our efforts.
Did CenterPoint underestimate the need for the amount of personnel to get this job done and done quickly?
Again, I think what the case was is we relied on information that we had at the time. And so we appropriately prepared for what we felt the event would be.
You obviously have been talking with, executive level, C-suite personnel, your colleagues at the company. Collectively, answer me this on behalf of our viewers. What could CenterPoint have done better with Hurricane Beryl?
I think that, again, we created a plan And when we identified that we needed additional resources, we ramped up that plan. I think that we will try our best to continue to proactively communicate to our customers, but as mentioned, there's more specific information that we can provide, and we are working to get there. We are in the first full day of restoration following this significant event. As you know, over 2 million customers, nearly 80% of our customer base being without. So we do need some time and understand that, you know, we're in a situation where people are without a critical service, but we need the time to gather the information so that when we can inform folks, we try to do so and be as accurate as we can. So we are trying to collect information and provide it. There's always opportunities for improvements, and we will work to resolve any issues that we encounter, but continue to serve our customers to the best of our ability.
So what are those opportunities for improvement? We previously spoke that in past hurricanes, CenterPoint had pre-staged out-of-town help nearby so that as soon as danger passed and the storm moved through, they could immediately hit the ground. The facts are the facts. Outside, CenterPoint outside help really has gotten out of the gate a half day late.
So I do want to clarify on one particular point. Sorry for interrupting you, but want to clarify that one particular point. While we did not have our crews that we had requested staged in Houston, we did have them in nearby locations so that once the storm passed, they could help with the response. And then as soon as it was safe to do so, be closer to our area. But safety is a top priority. So that was a major factor in exactly where we have these crews so that they were not in danger as the weather was coming through our area. So I did want to clarify that one point. While they were not in Houston, they were in nearby locations so that as soon as it was safe and Hurricane Beryl was out of the path of travel, they could make their way in.
I appreciate that. Where were those nearby locations?
Jeremy, again, factual information that I can look into and get back to you on that. But I do know that, and I wanted to clarify that point for you, that they were nearby so that as soon as it was safe to do so, they could come in and start helping with restoration.
I understand that, ma'am. You are the director of communications for this company. You just made a statement. I'm asking you to provide further corroboration of that statement. Your statement was those crews were nearby. I simply asked, where nearby? Were they in Beaumont? Were they in Corpus Christi? Were they a half an hour away? Were they 4 hours away? That's a fair question, and your paying customers deserve an answer.
It is, and let me get that information and get back to you, and then you can report that back. I don't have that information available to me, but I will get it and report that back to you.
In closing, what do you tell your customers in this footprint that have been affected? You have elderly people, you have folks with small children, infants. The heat index is well over 100 degrees. Please, this is an opportunity to shoot straight with the public and your customers. Do you owe them an apology for how you handled this event?
I think what I would say for our company is that we have a lot of dedicated folks that work for this company that are working around the clock to get our folks' power restored. And we understand that there are situations where we have folks with medical issues, health conditions, as you mentioned, elderly, and really just the everyday person where the current situation is not ideal. And we understand that. I myself and many of the other people that are working, a lot of our folks in the field working 16-hour days don't have power either. And so we understand the work that's ahead, the critical work that we're trying to get done as safely and as quickly as possible. And while I know that patience is thin at this point, we do appreciate that our customers, can hopefully understand that while we are experiencing challenges as we would in any event, maybe not always the same as every storm is not the same, we're doing everything that we can to get our customers restored.
To be clear here, though, having a lot of dedicated folks and working hard and then apologizing are two totally different things. You can have both things be true. You can apologize so maybe that may not have sat well with some people. But, you know, there's also a good chance that most people in the Houston area never heard or saw what she had to say because they don't have power.
Yeah. That was Alicia Schody, the spokeswoman for CenterPoint Energy. Jeremy's talked to her. Jeremy's talked to a number of other people, too, with CenterPoint. He's even gone out and done some of his own tests, which we're about to hear from in just a moment. And some of the things he found are unbelievable. How he sat in parking lots watching these trucks, these linemen who came in, who are getting paid a lot of money, wait for hours to get any orders on where to go, waiting to find out where they are needed to go to help restore power.
So he's been working these doubles every day, keeping up with all of this, trying to be a voice for people in the Houston area. And on top of working those doubles, he actually carved out. We told him it was going to be, you know, 10 minutes of his time. We never just take 10 minutes.
And why don't we take 10 minutes? Wheeler's questions. Wheeler's questions alone are 10 minutes, and I didn't warn Jeremy. So Jeremy's portion here is about 10 minutes, but it's an insightful interview, I think, right now that I hope folks in the Houston area can hear. And I hope lawmakers hear this, because why does Texas keep having trouble with electricity? Mm-hmm. This is the energy state, and what happened in Houston is another indication that we don't have things right in this state.
This is more than just the problem. Again, in CenterPoint's defense here, or in any utility's defense, this is more than just a problem with a single utility. And if it is just a problem with a single utility, should all of that responsibility and all of that power be held by a single utility?
Yeah. Let's hear from Jeremy here.
Hey, Rogo, good to see you again, man. Let's start out with how you and your family are doing first, man, because I know everybody's been in the dark. It's hot down there. Everyone's exhausted. What's life like for you guys right now, man?
People are hurting. There's no doubt. Our entire neighborhood is out of power, has been for several days. And you drive around, and it's just very apparent. You know, I think more than half the traffic signals down here in Houston are either completely out or flashing red, so the already congested Houston traffic is like exponentially worse right now. People are struggling, and there's no relief from the heat in sight. Every day is 104, 105, 106 degree heat index.
And Jeremy, I think that, you know, we definitely want to get into some of your reporting that you've been doing this week. It has just been stunning, some of the stuff that you've been revealing. But first of all, I mean, we're both from Houston as well, or at least Jason, you know, pretended to be for a while. Whiteley was a transplant there for a little bit, but I'm from there originally. This seems like this would be muscle memory by now to get all of this stuff back in place. Houston gets hit by storms constantly, and serious storms. I mean, this storm wasn't, you know, any stronger than a lot of them that have come through, but it doesn't seem like that muscle memory exists.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You know, I think the two main questions hovering over CenterPoint this entire week are, number one, were they slow out of the gate in their power restoration efforts? And number two, after the storm passed, have they been playing catch up? And I think those questions are warranted by CenterPoint's own numbers. If I can just take a second to break them down. Mm-hmm. Before the storm, they requested 2,500 what's called mutual assistance workers, the out of town guys who come in to help out. After the storm hit, they had to scramble to ramp that up to nearly a total of 12,000. So if you're down here at 2,500, then you got to go up here to 12,000. Look at that gap. Common sense says the mark was missed, and missed big time. Now, in fairness, CenterPoint says, hey, we planned accordingly based on, quote, the information we had at the time. But again, you're talking about needing 10,000 roughly more workers. You know, there's some serious follow-up questions to ask.
And the storm wasn't a surprise. We watched it coming for a week to 10 days. We knew it was hitting Texas at some point. We thought it was in Mexico, then South Texas, Brownsville, Corpus Christi, and then it moved on up to Matagorda Bay. Again, you and I, we've all seen these storms come ashore from the Gulf, and trying to nail down why they weren't ready is the big thing that I'm still shocked about. But you've been asking questions. You've been trying to get answers from a number of people, from the director of communications at CenterPoint up to some of the C-suite folks as well. I'm curious what kind of reactions you've had to your story, because for people who don't realize it, in TV news, if you do multiple stories, that means you keep getting tips, you keep getting more information, you keep getting feedback from the community. And I can't imagine that you haven't had, you know, just gobs of that.
You know, we're the voice for the voiceless, right? That's what we do as journalists. You know that, Jason. And, you know, people, I go into an interview asking the questions that my neighbors want to ask, that my friends want to ask, that really everybody's asking. and really just trying to hold their feet to the fire. You know, to your earlier point about the trajectory of the path, you know, a day afterwards, Lieutenant Governor, Acting Governor Dan Patrick said, I'd be shocked if anyone were to say, you know, this doesn't have a chance at coming straight to Houston. And so, again, it goes back to that preparedness from Centerpoint. You know, we asked the director of communications, well, where did you stage these crews? And, you know, because they weren't in Houston. Everybody that first day, guys, that afternoon, the storm had passed about noon, 1 o'clock. Everybody said, where are the trucks? I haven't seen a truck. Where are the trucks? And the answer was, there were no outside trucks Monday. And so Centerpoint only had their local crews, about 1,500, and they were waiting for the cavalry to come in. And so by Centerpoint's own admission, you know, they were a half a day late out of the gate.
You know, even when all those trucks arrived from out of town, though, Jeremy, you all did this brilliant thing where you went to these different staging areas and essentially saw workers sitting still for hours and trucks parked for a good chunk of the day as people were waiting for marching orders. Can you kind of walk through that a little bit?
Yeah. So this was a snapshot. This was kind of a unscientific exercise, right? But you know, in past storms, I would notice, my friends would notice, family would notice, hey, there's all these trucks over at such and such parking lot at the mall or at the high school or wherever they were staged. And why aren't they out in the field? Obviously, you can't cut down trees and repair lines in a mall parking lot. You have to get out to the field. Right. So in short, we had eyes on three sites. One up northwest of Houston, one west Houston, one down in Galveston. And it was actually an out-of-state lineman who had driven 1,200 miles to answer the call for help, and he agreed to help us. And long and short of it, you know, one of the sites, we got there at 8 o'clock. It took 11:30 for two bucket trucks we had sort of isolated on to get out the door. And then a tree trimming truck, it took till almost 12:30 to get out. And by the time that truck got on site, the first tree branch was cut at like 1:18 in the afternoon. So we got there at 8, and that little snapshot, the first tree branch is cut at 1:18. That's 5+ hours before any measurable work was done. Now, we're not saying that this is, you know, was repetitive throughout the 18 staging sites. And Centerpoint says this is not the norm. This would be the exception. But I think it was an illuminating look at just, you know, what goes on and some kind of pulling back the curtain to say, okay, this is maybe why it's taking so long to get people restored. 4 or 5 hours to get them out the door. You know, let the viewer decide on that. But I think common sense and logic says that's inefficient.
I'm sure a lot of folks in Houston are calling for heads to roll at Centerpoint. I saw some graffiti, I think it's on I-10 near downtown, that said Centerpointless, which kind of made the rounds on social media. You got a moment to ask Acting Governor Dan Patrick a few questions in a press conference in Galveston. Obviously, the mode they were in right then was kind of search and recovery, making sure everyone is okay and trying to get power restored. But you asked him, what do you think that the state can do to hold Centerpoint accountable? What was his reaction to that?
Well, at first, he said Centerpoint will have to answer for themselves. And I pressed. And I said, listen, yes, it's a private company, but they are a public utility. And there is regulatory oversight by the PUC, the Public Utility Commission of Texas. And the lieutenant governor, then acting governor, picked up on that. And he said, yes, we will essentially ask the PUC, you know, for a full post-event analysis. And I think if there is any real change to be made, and this is more down your all's alley, covering politics regularly, is that's where it's going to have to happen. Because, you know, otherwise, you know, who has any teeth in you know, putting Centerpoint under the microscope? We'll see, right, when the dust settles. Obviously, we got to get the lights back on first.
Yeah, because ultimately here, you know, I mean, here we are. I'm in Dallas right now. In one of my bedrooms right now is my mother, because she is a Houston resident. She doesn't have power like so many others, and no timeline for when it will be back either. She checks every day. And, you know, I was concerned about her and wanted to get her out of there because ultimately, Jeremy, and I'm sure that you've encountered this, this is a safety issue. This is a health issue for a lot of folks. This is dangerous. I mean, you know, we talk about being uncomfortable and not having AC and so forth. You know, if you're living in parts of Canada, you know, that might be a creature comfort. When you're living in Houston, Texas, and it's July, it is a necessity.
Without a doubt, it has moved from inconvenience to serious life safety. You have, you know, CenterPoint customers who are elderly. You have CenterPoint customers with various medical conditions. We talked to a couple. They had two young daughters. One was near four. One was 4 months old. You know, it doesn't take a medical doctor to say, you know, if it's 90 plus degrees inside your home and you're caring for a baby, that's not good. And so, yes, as time goes on, this is no longer, oh, I don't have, you know, the conveniences of normal life. This is serious, you know, life-threatening scenarios we got talking here.
Jeremy, we just heard from the CenterPoint spokeswoman the extended interview you guys have posted at KHOU.com, and it was a 23-minute interview, I believe. I was surprised at a number of things she said. The first thing is that she did not take the opportunity to apologize to customers, even with something as simple as like, you know, we could have done better. You know, hats off to the guys in the field and the bucket trucks. And thanks to all the folks who have come in. We're going to, you know, go back to the drawing board and figure this out. And then I was really struck that she couldn't say what CenterPoint needs to do differently next time. Like Jason mentioned earlier, this is old hat for Houston. You guys have been dealing with storms for decades and centuries, essentially. But improving the or getting the outage map back online so folks aren't relying on Whataburger to find out where the lights are on. Right. That's one obvious thing to do. Isn't it obvious that they need to, you know, take another look at their forecasting room and whoever's forecasting these storms and how much pre-planning they need to do? You know how it works. And folks who don't, you know, realize, maybe first responders, when there's a call for something that goes out, whether it's a shooting or a car wreck or a building explosion, first responders send everything they have and then they pare back as needed. The fact that CenterPoint didn't do this is shocking to me, and I'm sure frustrating to folks in Houston.
Even more so, Jason, is after that interview with the director of communications, the head PR person, we then talked to a company executive and I asked them the same question 2 days later. Would you have done anything differently? And he said no. And dug his heels in. And you know, I remember there was a police chief here a while back, Charles McClellan, said, you know what? If we mess up, we're going to fess up and we're going to fix it. Mm-hmm. Clearly, that has not been the mindset that we're hearing from CenterPoint. You know, ultimately, the public, you know, will decide. But the court of public opinion, unfortunately, you know, doesn't have any sway here. You know, they are not elected leaders. They're not elected. You can't go to the ballot box and vote the CEO out of office of CenterPoint. They're their own, you know, company. And so, yeah, I was struck too at the tone from the get-go and the continued tone that, hey, you know, what we did, we're comfortable with in CenterPoint's eyes. And I think a lot of people are questioning that as well.
Jeremy, I thought it was interesting that you even teed this up. I mean, it was like sitting there on a silver platter where, you know, and you're not asking to be, you know, hard on anybody. You're almost asking to give an opportunity here. Like, hey, you know, do you think that you owe, you know, the people here an apology for, you know, what has happened, or would you like to say that to them or whatever? And you didn't get that. They didn't even give that.
Yeah. I mean, they did kind of walk that back in subsequent interviews, you know, the language a la, we empathize, we understand. But yeah, initially, I was miffed by that reaction as well.
Now, you know, to be fair to CenterPoint here, they said that they've done something they've never done before, and that was to restore 1 million customers in 48 hours. That is great news. It's not great news when you still have, you know, as many or more people who still don't have power, and you're going into days and days of, you know, terrible heat. I think I'm struck by this, and I guess this is going to have to go back to state regulators as well. This was at one point, what was it, a Cat 5 storm in the very beginning, as it raked across, you know, some of the islands in the Caribbean. I'm struck by how quickly our infrastructure here seems to melt, you know, under something like this. This was a Cat 1 storm when it came ashore in Texas. Again, you would think that the Texas coast, especially, you know, with Refinery Row there in Houston, this is a strategically important place. You would think that it would be sort of a more hardened place infrastructure wise than what we've seen here.
Yeah. And what we're hearing from CenterPoint is unlike the derecho event in mid-May, nearly 2 months ago, where, I mean, in my neighborhood, you had trees that had three and a half feet diameter trees coming down, right? Mm. This wasn't so much that. It was more small trees and heavy limbs and big branches, but more of them, okay? Mm. You didn't have those big high voltage transmission towers come crumpling down. You know, CenterPoint saying it was more kind of the wires and poles level thing. And so that, and, you know, we're always thinking follow-up stories here, that goes back to what kind of maintenance? What is the maintenance record for CenterPoint? And we're, you know, we're starting to get some tips on that, and don't have anything solid yet, but it's something fair to look at. You know, if you have 100 trees, listen, Mother Nature is always going to win, right? Because that's the way Mother Nature is. But if you have 100 trees and, you know, maybe let's say, and I don't even know this number, 20 come down or branches come down. But what if you did better maintenance where they're not dangling over the wires? Can you cut that in half? Can you cut that in third? I don't know the numbers, but we're going to be taking a closer look at the maintenance record of CenterPoint. Because if a tree doesn't fall on a wire, the wire doesn't go down, the power, the homes connected to the wire don't lose power. Mm-hmm. It's ABC. So yeah, hardened infrastructure, but also on the maintenance side too, is something to look at.
I would think that the state might be interested in some comparisons there, because I know Oncor, which is the sister sort of CenterPoint for the North Texas region. This is the, you know, transmission and distribution utility that basically handles the lines and the poles. I know that Oncor has been really proactive for the past several years. And in fact, they've, you know, earned the ire of some people who are like, why are you cutting down those branches? Stop cutting down these trees. And, you know, it makes the trees form kind of strangely in a big U around a power line, because they don't want the branches anywhere above a power line. I do wonder what the comparisons are like when you start looking at these different transmission utilities around Texas, because they sort of, you know, develop their own plans there. But it could be useful in a place like Houston. And I would imagine that state regulators might want to look at, you know, what have these different utilities been doing with regard to that, because it can make a huge difference.
Well, and one further, Jason, is what is the percentage of CenterPoint's footprint that wires are underground? Okay, buried in the ground rather than above with your, you know, old school poles and wires and trees. Mm-hmm. That's something else we want to look at. Not only within Texas and the different TDUs, as you mentioned, the Oncors, the Entergies and the like, but in other states. Mm-hmm. You know, Miami, for instance, has a large percentage underground because, mm-hmm. you know, they're in a bullseye. So again, there's a whole lot of follow-up here to do from an investigative reporter standpoint, and this is going to be a story that isn't going away anytime soon.
And Jeremy, I know you have a lot more reporting to do. Last question I had for you here, just from what you've seen so far, is there anything clear that needs to be done, that CenterPoint needs to do, that you would tell lawmakers, hey, you guys really got to take a look at this, or the PUC, take a look at this. This is the evidence from our reporting.
It's the pre-planning. Hmm. It's okay. You know, common sense and logic would say, doesn't it make sense to go big early? And if extra crews aren't needed, you send them back where they came from, rather than going small from the get-go and rolling the proverbial dice. And, you know, people a lot smarter than me who analyze this stuff will say, you know, it's a cost balance sort of equation. We talked to the one lineman who came from way out of state. He said, I'm making $100 an hour. You know, he also sat on the clock for about 4.5 hours before he even hit the road. And so multiply that by 10,000 workers. And, you know, I don't even know how many millions we're talking about. And so, you know, I think from to answer your question is, do they have to file a plan before a big storm comes in? Do they have to submit something to this PUC that says, listen, we are requesting X thousand outside personnel, mutual assistance workers? Does the PUC have authority to sign off on that, to green light it? I don't know the answer to that. But clearly, there has got to be some lessons learned from this event. And it is going to be up to state leadership to step in. That's the only way.
Yeah,
And we will just see if that happens. It hasn't always in the past, as you guys know.
I think you're making a great point there, Jeremy. And, you know, it doesn't need to be all bottom up. And maybe it needs to be some top down, too. You know, it seems like as a state, you know, the state might want to be interested in jumping in there and doing a little bit more, being a little bit more proactive as well, because, you know, we can't all just pin our hopes on a single utility to figure it all out and do it right and get the, you know, right things done when we have these big calamities like this, because too many people's, you know, lives and their health are hanging in the balance here. Your reporting, though, is, I think, going to give regulators a lot to chew on this time around.
Good stuff, Jeremy. Great work, man.
I appreciate that, guys. Thanks for having me.